Welcome to Necromaniacs Podcast, episode number 8.
We are back, everybody, after a little bit of a break in January and February. We're back for March in the midst of a snowstorm in New York. And, you know, still deep into the crap weather. But the other day we had a loss in the, I would say, in the Necromaniacs world.
Absolutely.
The passing of the great Leonard Nimoy at age 83.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, like most people, was got familiar with Leonard Nimoy through through Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Spock. But then also, I became a huge fan of In Search of.
Yes, which to me is I mean, I'm not a tremendous Star Trek guy at all. I like it, and I think I appreciate it now more than I ever did. But In Search of, as a kid boy, was the greatest thing ever. It was on Sundays, I believe,
yeah.
The new episodes. But I also watched the reruns, too, I remember, later on in the 80s. But it started in, I believe, the late 70s, and it carried into about the early 80s, about 5 or 6 seasons. And, man, when I have described this show to people younger, they're like, wow, this show sounds so cool.
Yeah.
It was a show that talked all about the crazy-ass stuff of the day back in the 70s. Whether it be, you know, the cryptozoological stuff, mm-hmm. Nostradamus, yeah. UFOs, cults, witchcraft. There was an Amityville Horror episode.
Yep. The Loch Ness
Monster. You
name
it. It was like a dream come true show.
Yeah.
You know, for like people into the crap that me and Mike are into.
Yeah, totally.
And for the longest time, actually, it was unavailable. No VHS, no nothing. It was, you had to buy bootlegs that looked like crap, YouTubes that looked like crap. In late 2012, the box set came out. Or a box set had come out that I believe was not U.S. region. Then a U.S. region one, that which is out now, which I forgot came out. I was so excited. I wanted to buy it, and I never bought it. But lo and behold, of course, in the wake of Leonard Nimoy's death, got me completely thinking about In Search of again. So I made the purchase on Amazon. You can still get it on Amazon. It's the In Search of box set. It has the entire run of the show, including 2 episodes that Rod Serling hosted before Leonard Nimoy did, which I didn't even know, which is also cool. And it comes with the 1 season from the early 2000s revival, which I do remember, kind of.
I didn't even know that happened.
Yeah, that happened. It was 1 season. So it literally is like a pack to the gills box set, which I bought in remembrance and love for Leonard Nimoy, and in remembrance of love for In Search of course.
So this episode is dedicated to the memory of Leonard Nimoy.
Absolutely. Live long and prosper. And The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins is probably one of the single greatest things you can watch on YouTube in the history of YouTube. It's just the coolest thing ever. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Mike?
No.
In 1967, both him and Shatner started singing or whatever, making records.
I know that Shatner has a
yeah.
prolific
vocal
career.
And it's basically a music video 10, 12 years before there were music videos. It's called The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins. And it is Nimoy with the Spock ears and the Spock haircut singing this song about Bilbo Baggins with 5 hot 60s chicks surrounding him. It is one of the greatest things on YouTube forever. It's got like over 2 million views on it. There's like a few different, you know, versions of it. You have to see it.
Damn. All right.
And it's called, yes, Nimoy Sings, The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins. Huh. I mean, I immediately ran to the clip after hearing that he died because it made me think about it. And like, you know, just picture late 60s kind of chilling Nimoy. He's on like a beach and he's got like these cute 60s pixie girls surrounded him. It's pretty great stuff. You got to check it out.
So the theme of this episode is the dead of winter because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, we're in the middle of like a pretty brutal winter.
Mm.
And some people say, oh yeah, I mean, the winter's been so bad. But you know what? When I was a kid, I remember having winters like this on a routine basis.
See, you know what? That's the thing. People are forgetting that this was every winter for a while back, I think, in the 80s. And then in the 90s and 2000s, winters were pretty damn mild. So when we get something like this, we literally have no recollection of winters this bad before. So I kind of agree with you, although I feel like this one and last year were horrendous. But you may be right on the point.
Also, it's just been bitter cold, too.
Yeah, that is no fun at all. 20 below, 24 below, in Brooklyn. That is weird, I feel like, no?
Yeah. So that leads us to the theme of this current episode, where Mike and I are, we're going to talk about our top five winter horror films.
Now, people a lot of times associate horror movies a lot with fall or summer. Maybe just fall in particular, Halloween, things like that. But I feel like winter is even a better time to delve into horror because you're, you know, snowed in. You don't want to go out as much. What are you going to do? You're going to watch movies for hours and hours.
So, we both kind of have, similar tastes in movies. So, sort of as expected, we had a lot of the same entries on this list.
Yes. We did a top five, shortened it down a bit so that we could have more time to discuss other things.
You want to start at the top of the list or at the bottom?
You know what? We can start at the bottom, sure.
Yeah. So my number five is a movie called Ravenous. It came out in 1999 and was directed by Antonia Bird. I haven't really heard of any... Well, I've researched some of the movies she's done, but I haven't seen any of them. Apparently, it's mostly TV movies, TV shows. And, stuff like, the Twilight Saga, A Passionate Woman. Not something that's on my bucket list.
Not a lot of horror in the canon there, no. Yeah.
So, but this stars in, like, a younger Guy Pearce, who, I think he's great.
Yeah.
Great Australian actor.
Definitely.
And it sort of, like, ties in with the Wendigo, Donner Pass. It's a period piece. It takes place in the 1800s. And Pierce plays a guy named Boyd who is, fights in the Mexican-American War. And he's a coward. And there's, like, scenes of him in battle laying underneath a pile of dead bodies and blood dripping in his mouth. And he's kind of playing dead, but then miraculously he jumps to and ends up capturing the whole command, and he's like the sole survivor of this massacre and is promoted. But his commanding officer knows that he's a coward, so he sort of banishes him to some hinterland outpost with a bunch of other sort of miscreants, and there's a couple of familiar faces in this. There's the guy that I recognized him immediately. This guy, Jeremy Davies. He played Charles Manson in the remake.
Helter Skelter remake. Not a bad actor.
He was in Saving Private Ryan. He was also in a couple episodes of Lost, and he was in another movie that was it's kind of like a little bit sort of obscure called Spanking the Monkey.
I do remember that. Was he the male lead?
He was
in
the guy.
Movie?
Oh, okay, guy yeah. His mom.
I remember that movie. Yep.
Once again, like pretty obscure film. He was pretty young, came out a while ago. He's like a sort of a guy I keep my eye on. Whenever I see him in a movie, he pops up here and there. He made a great Charles Manson, by the way.
Yeah, he did actually. I remember seeing that one.
And also David Arquette's in that movie. Plays a
hasn't been doing much in the last few years.
No? Just chilling,
Yeah, being David Arquette.
He plays a typical sort of Arquette style character, kind of like low-level guy, comedy relief. And I guess that's what this movie is. More of a dark comedy than like a straight-up horror movie, but there's definitely a pretty heavy, horrific element to it, with cannibalism and a supernatural element with the spirit of the Wendigo. For those of you who don't know about the Wendigo, it's a Native American legend where, it eats the, cannibalizes, takes on the powers of... the life force of other creatures.
I always liken the Wendigo as the winter Bigfoot for some reason. I don't know why in my cryptozoological mind frame. But there's a lot more to the Wendigo than the Bigfoot, obviously.
Yeah. Also, there was that character, and it was Alpha Flight.
Yes, with the same name, the big dude. Yep.
The Canadian X-Men.
Yes.
So this movie sort of follows the path of Boyd, the coward, banished out in the hinterlands, and sort of out this boring camp. He's like the third in command, and one day some guy rolls up, and he tells this story of a story very similar to the Donner Pass, where there's like a group of settlers across in the mountains, the Sierra Nevadas, coincidentally, which is where Donner Pass is, and they get stranded, you know, snowed in, people start eating each other, and this guy claims to be the escapee of that sort of cannibal massacre that happens in the snow. Turns out that this guy leads them into an ambush, and he's actually the guy behind all this carnage, and he actually is a supernaturally sort of possessed, you know, being. Then things get crazy, you know, and I highly recommend this movie.
Yeah, I did see this movie many years ago.
Yeah.
It was from 97. I probably saw it in 97 or 98, and I always remember that Guy Pearce was in it, but my recollection of it is very bad, so I kind of want to see it again. Rediscover it.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so definitely check that one out. You know,
that's great.
Winter cannibal fun.
My number five is a movie that unfortunately shares the name with one of Disney's biggest movies in the history of the company. It is from 2010, and it is called Frozen. Not to be confused with the hit cartoon that some of your children might really, really like or are obsessed with, and that goddamn pop song that's everywhere, Let It Go. Don't ask me why I know what that is, but I know what that is. Mike has no idea what I'm even saying right now.
Yeah, it's a Def Leppard song.
Exactly, Let It Go. But anyway, it's directed by Adam Green, who directed before this the Hatchet series of films. Not too into those movies myself, the Hatchet movies, but nonetheless, I know they have a huge fan base. And it stars Kevin Zegers, Sean Ashmore, who is, oddly enough, Iceman in all the X-Men movies here in this winter horror movie, and Emma Bell. It's basically about three friends at a ski lodge who have the unfortunate luck of basically being the last group on the, you know, the ski resort, so to speak, to be on the lift. And the guy running the lift, I mean, this is, I'm just kind of simplifying it as much as I can. The guy running the lift happens to see another set of three skiers coming back after he's kind of been away from the, you know, that machine for a while. And basically mistakes that as the three that were the last ones down and shuts off the machine. In the middle of winter, you know, high above ground, you have the three main characters of the movie stuck on a shutdown ski lift in the dead of winter in the snow, which is basically the crux of the movie.
That's brutal.
It's a small cast. The crux of the movie is these three people on the ski lift. When it came out in 2010, I do remember it. Back then, I used to have a shop, as Mike knows, Brooklyn Monster Factory, and I remember that Anchor Bay was, you know, soliciting for it, and it had a really cool kind of cover on the DVD of like a guy kind of hanging on for his life on like a ski lift. But for whatever reason, I never actually got to see the movie until literally about a month and a half ago, while researching winter horror movies. Believe it or not. It premiered, February 5th, 2010. It actually was at Sundance first that year. And, according to Wikipedia, basically, it caused quite a stir with numerous faintings reported from audience members that could not handle the tension of the film. Hmm. Now, I have to say, there is a lot of tension in the film. It gets very kind of claustrophobic. And, you know, you're definitely kind of drawn in. But I don't know about that whole fainting thing. I think that you must have a very, you know, low tolerance for your horror if you're fainting during this movie.
That's a claim that a lot of horror movies.
Yeah, I know. I mean, who knows how real it is? As far as the other kind of reviews and the word of mouth for it, Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 61% out of 89 critics. They're saying it has the beginnings of an inventive, frightening film, but the script and the cast are not quite strong enough to do it justice. I will say the acting is a bit uneven, but I do feel like the movie itself draws you in, and some of the things that happen throughout the movie are really fucked up. And I kind of don't even want to say what happens in the movie because it's not such a seen film, and I would like people to kind of discover it on its own, you know? It's not a very happy ending for these three characters, but there's an incident involving wolves. That's one thing I'll say. And an incident involving an attempt to jump down off the ski lift to go get help, which is probably the worst idea I've ever seen in my life for someone stuck on a ski lift about 50 to 100 feet off the air. But It is a movie you should seek out. It's not on Netflix. It's not in a lot of places. I believe it is on iTunes. I got the hard disk, actually. I was able to get a copy for a decent price. You know, it's on Anchor Bay, so it is available and out there, you know, widely distributed. But it's gotten a bit of a rub as of, you know, due to the name, Frozen. But again, this is, you know, not a Disney movie. This is a pretty damn good independent horror film.
It's such a simple plot setup, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's the crux of the movie, literally. Yeah. The three of them kind of figuring out what to do, trying not to freak out, not to pass out. There's a whole thing about having to go to the bathroom, and it's just, I mean, it gets really tense. You're definitely drawn in.
Yeah, whenever it's cold out, I have to pee a lot more.
Yes, so yes.
That's like a big concern as well.
But, so, yeah, it's a fun movie.
So my number four is 30 Days of Night.
And it's also my number four. So
really?
We could kind of do it in right conjunction.
You want to do the technical stuff, you know, like...
I didn't have the technical stuff handy for this one.
All right. So it came out in 2007. It was directed by David Slade. You might know him from Hard Candy.
A great, great movie, actually. Yeah.
The Twilight Saga. I made a mistake, actually. Antonia Bird did not have anything to do with the Twilight Saga. She had to do with the Village TV series.
Mm, okay.
Something, another thing I haven't seen.
Yeah, David Slade did indeed direct Twilight Eclipse. Yeah.
And also Hannibal TV series.
Mm-hmm.
That's on my list of things to see. Because I heard from you, I think, it was awesome.
I saw season one and most of season two, and I kind of punched out. But I will say what I did see, I did enjoy, and I think you would enjoy it.
And the story is based on the comic by Steve Niles. The comic was published
by IDW.
Fantastic
comic, yes.
That's why I saw the movie, because I originally read the comic back in the late 90s when it came out. And it stars Josh Hartnett, who I've always been sort of a fan of his. You know, he seems like a likable. He plays like a good likable guy.
Yeah.
And he plays Eben Olsen, who's like the main character. Danny Houston plays Marlowe, the head vampire. And if you're watching American Horror Story, Danny Houston is also in the last couple of seasons of American Horror Story.
Hmm.
Yeah, awesome. He's great. I love him. So this movie in particular takes place in Alaska. It has that sort of isolation vibe. The movie starts the last day of sunlight before Alaska is plunged into 30 days of endless darkness.
A genius concept for a vampire movie or book.
Yeah, just it's brilliant, you know. And a lot of people didn't really like this movie. I was, you know, whenever I bring it up in certain circles, people are like, yeah, I don't really care for it. But I like it mainly because I love the comic book. I like Steve Niles.
Yeah.
And also, that's how I want to see vampires.
A very brutal portrayal of vampires. No elegance. No, no beauty, just very like violent and scary and creepy. Yeah,
and you want to know more about like the backstory and the vampires too. That's the thing that's cool about it. It's like they're clearly like another type of another species. They speak their own language.
Yes, they do have their own language. Yep.
You know, and you know, even like as I watched this, and even as I read the comic, I was like, you know, years ago, I was like, my mind was like racing about like, oh yeah, maybe this is like some ancient civilization that existed before some apocalypse. And they were, you know, made up my own storyline around where the vampires came from and who they are. Because there's also references to, you know, turning other people and they're not being original vampires and all this other stuff.
Right,
and,
right.
You know,
it's an interesting concept.
It's a really cool concept, which, and I love when movies, when they do that, when they just kind of tickle your imagination and then, but they don't tell you exactly what's going on. But yeah, great, great vampires, brutal, relentless, you know. And, you know, it's sort of like an unsung film for the reason that a lot of people seem not to be into it.
Absolutely. I forgot this was from Ghost House, which is Sam Raimi and Tappert from, you know, the Evil Dead guys. And I also forgot that this was actually quite a hit. The budget was $30 million. It made over $102 million at the box office.
Oh, great.
So it did very well.
Good.
But you're right. It seems that people are kind of iffy about this movie for whatever reason. So that's why I almost feel like it's great for, another review in the winter time.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Well, especially if you're living in New York and you're, you know, you're under the brutal weather here.
Yeah.
It's like a perfect movie. I rewatched it over the weekend, you know, when it was about 2 degrees out. And, and it was nice. But yeah, it's because I know when it did come out in 2007, just because I'm always sort of reluctant to embrace a lot of horror comic.
Mm.
Like, superhero films are cool, like, you know, when they make movies out of them. But, like, when there's the horror element, like Swamp Thing or something like that, I always feel like they drop the ball on the horror comics.
Yeah, like, case in point, I feel like the Hellblazer TV series, you know, Constantine, is not as nearly as good as the comic. It doesn't even come anywhere close to it, to the point that it's kind of, I'm almost upset that it's even on the air. But I know what you're saying. But this was not an example of that. This was an example of something I thought that translated very well into a movie, and that I thought they did a great job with the, you know, graphic novel and the original material.
And I love the vampires, man.
Yeah.
Just like, these are creepy, like, they look like if, like, the bad seeds were vampires, you know, these sort of black, like, black coats and white collared shirts, like, emerging from the darkness, you know, sort of really cool, you know, just brutal. But, yeah, they're like, my favorite vampires. You know, I'm not a big vampire fan in general. You know, Bram Stoker's Dracula, obviously, is a classic. But, and you also mentioned a movie called The Habit, which I need to see, which is a vampire film.
Yes. But I am a big vampire guy. I mean, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula, last year's Kiss of the Vampire. I try to give every vampire movie a shot, you know, or, you know, at least one solid viewing. But, no, 30 Days of Night I always liked, and now I kind of want to give it another viewing, just to kind of, you know, pay attention to some of the things about, like you were saying, the origin of the vampire characters in there. Absolutely.
Yeah, because, like, they're speaking some ancient language, you know, and then there's also some statement in the movie about how they spent thousands of years convincing humans that they didn't exist, and that's why they had to annihilate that entire town.
Because
if somebody escaped and they said, you know, there's vampires in Antarctica, they would blow their whole spot, you know. So, yeah, just that kind of thing is always something I'm interested in, you know. I mean, I'm like a big conspiracy theory fan, you know, like the reptilian overlords and all this other stuff. So that stuff's always like, if it has something about hidden knowledge or something like that, I'm into it right away. So, yeah, that had enough of that element in it to make me interested in it.
Cool. My number three is something that's only on my list. And it's Misery from 1990, based on the Stephen King film, directed by Rob Reiner, Meathead from All in the Family, no less. Released on September 30th, 1990. I remember going to see it in the theater, November 30th, 1990. I remember it was a huge movie. I remember it was a very big deal. And people were interested to see what Rob Reiner was going to do, you know, with this very popular, like, horror novel from Stephen King. And Kathy Bates won a damn Oscar for it, which is surprising because no one really wins Oscars for horror movies all that much. But to some people, Misery isn't really a horror movie. To me, it is, but I could see how some people would say it's like a psychological thriller, quote unquote. But to me, it is a horror film. Anyway, the rough plot summary is best-selling novelist Paul Sheldon, played by the amazing James Caan of Godfather fame, is on his way home from his Colorado hideaway after completing his latest book when he crashes his car in a freak blizzard. He's critically injured but is rescued by former nurse Annie Wilkes, Kathy Bates, of course, who is an obsessed, quote-unquote, number one fan who takes her back to his house and basically back to her house and basically doesn't let him leave. Keeps him there permanently. I always thought that the tension in this movie was great, and I always thought that Kathy Bates was super believable as a psychotic, obsessed fan. And I feel like there's not a lot of movies that feature kind of like the psychotic woman anymore in the mainstream of films. I feel like this was kind of going on more in the early 90s, late 80s, Hand That Rocks the Cradle kind of thing. And I feel like Hollywood kind of doesn't really touch that anymore until very recently. I don't know if you saw Gone Girl.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, my, a fantastic movie.
Yeah, a lot of twists.
I mean, you, just when you thought you knew what was going on, you had no idea what was going on. In a way, I mean, there's only a semi-parallel to Gone Girl Misery, but I felt like we hadn't seen a crazy-ass woman in a long time. And this movie, you know, brings me back to that time of seeing these type of characters in film. Yeah, it was a tremendous film. Won other Academy Awards as well. And it was around the time when, you know, early 90s, where there was a lot of Stephen King activity going on. You had the It TV movie, you had this movie, you had The Stand. You know, Stephen King was getting a lot of love back then. Not as much now. He still, you know, he still has his projects, but he was more of the super hot property back then. What did you think of Misery, Mike?
I loved it. I thought it was great. I actually thought it was probably one of the top two Stephen King adaptions.
Yeah.
You know, because like his films, like the film adaptions of his books haven't really, you know,
they're up and down.
Really, mm-hmm. They're up and down, definitely, you know, and, but that was definitely one of the top five of his
yeah,
films.
Yeah, no,
adaptions.
Absolutely. Pet Sematary, another
Pet
one.
Pet Sematary, and, you know, I love James Caan. I mean,
yeah.
He's Sonny, you know?
Sonny forever.
Sonny
yes.
Corleone, you know, how you not like him. And that was the first time I've seen Kathy Bates, you know, was in that film.
Mm-hmm.
And, once again, she's in a regular on American Horror Story.
Right, right.
You need to check that out.
Which
man.
She's apparently killing it there, too. So.
Yeah, she's killing it. She's always, I love her. I think she's
and
great.
Then a few years later, another movie I saw around the same time as I watched Misery in January. Dolores Claiborne, which is a really good movie itself. Not much of a horror film, but a really dark, bleak, kind of depressing film to watch in the winter.
Yeah.
And it's also Kathy Bates, another great performance, and the amazing Jennifer Jason Leigh, great performance. Very cool movie.
Whatever happened to Jennifer Jason Leigh?
I believe she is still acting, but again, not as active as her, you know, mid-90s
yeah.
fame, you know.
Whenever I think of two movies when I think of Jennifer Jason Leigh. Three movies.
Okay.
Last Exit to Brooklyn.
Yes.
Great. Tra-la-la. She
played. Oh, my God. Brutal movie.
Yeah. The book is even more brutal. Like the actual book
yeah.
source material.
Right.
Existenz.
Yes.
Excellent,
underrated film.
Excellent
yes. Great movie.
And, and also Rush, the movie
Rush,
with Jennifer,
yes.
Jason Patric, where they're, and Greg Allman is in it,
mm-hmm.
and it's like that drug movie.
I need to see that movie again. I haven't seen it in 100 years.
Yeah, Jason Patric rules. That's a guy who kind of fades in and out.
And I'm going to add a few more Jennifer Jason Leigh loves. Single White Female.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High, of
oh,
course.
Oh, shit.
Her debut.
That's right.
And Easy Money. Where she is the daughter of Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh, you know, I don't remember.
Unbelievable. Oh, you have to see these movies again.
That's
fantastic. Easy Money is a great film. Joe Pesci, Rodney Dangerfield, set in Staten Island. It is one of the greatest comedies ever. It's a pretty crazy movie.
Let me ask you a question about Fast Times.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, like, kids these days would watch that movie and relate to it at all?
No, I have a funny side story I could tell you. I'm at St. Vitus a year ago. And I'm talking to a friend of mine, and he has this girl with him who literally looks like Phoebe Cates.
Oh.
She is drop-dead gorgeous.
Wow.
She's stunning. And I talk to her, whatever, a little small talk, and I say, anyone ever tell you you look like Phoebe Cates? And she goes, who's that? And I go, oh, she's in the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High? What's that? And then that was pretty much over. Yeah, she had no idea what the movie was nor
wow.
who the actress was. So, you know, I'm going to say maybe not.
That was a genre, man. There was that movie. There was Last American Virgin. It was that sort of like high school, you know, sex.
Yeah.
You know, first time, coming of age, soundtrack oriented film.
Here's the thing. The last attempt at that, and it did okay, was the American Pie era. Those movies were fun, but they were not music-based.
No.
And I don't even know how much... I mean, they resonated in the pop culture of the day, definitely. But I don't know if, say, even a 17 to 19-year-old of now gives a rat's ass about that movie. So it's just... It's kind of interesting. I feel like they would get a kick out of some of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the overall kind of, like... vibe of it, you know what I'm saying, would this might be lost. To it. Yes, could not be related. No.
Scalping tickets and
I mean, I almost feel like a lot of kids today don't even have jobs. So even the working thing, I don't even know if they can relate to that. So who knows, man? I mean, maybe the only thing they could relate to is the sex. That's probably maybe the only thing.
Maybe. I kind of think like, you know, like your parents, like our parents, when you would watch like American Graffiti, mm-hmm. you know, and our parents would relate to the 50s.
Right.
You know, because there's movies, you know, those movies had like, you know, the music they listened to and situations they're familiar with. In some ways, I feel like Fast Times at Ridgemont High and like the, you know, 16 Candles and all mm-hmm. that stuff is kind of like guys like our age. You know, people our age, mm-hmm. that's like our American Graffiti now.
In a way, yes. I mean, I'm a little younger than you, and I was not even in high school during Fast Times or Pretty in Pink or 16 Candles. But I will say this, that was my impression of high school then. That is what I thought high school was like.
Yeah.
And I was kind of sorely disappointed in a way. I went to high school from 87 to 91. If anything, I caught the ass end of that vibe. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
A little bit in 87, 88, whatever. But I do think every era's has its movies. You know what I'm saying? And has its movies that kind of define its era. And I'm wondering what a teenager today thinks about certain movies like that and would maybe think it is a movie that's like, oh my God, I love this movie and I'm obsessed with this movie. Who knows?
I have an idea of what movie would encapsulate the sort of young people's experience of this day and age. And it was a movie that you told me about called Megan is Missing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I don't think I'm over that movie, to be honest. I'm still really not over that movie.
Yeah. The gist of that movie is, the concept is that it was put together on, like, you know, cell phone movies and videos and selfies and kind of woven together with, news footage and had a sort of found footage vibe to it. And it was basically about some girl who was like abducted by some guy out, you know, and there's like some brutality in there that I cannot.
Yeah.
It felt so real, man.
And here's the thing. It looks like it was made for like $20, but that adds to the vibe of it in a way, right? Like it just,
oh yeah.
It seems like a PSA made by a highly disturbed director is basically kind of what it comes across as.
Yeah.
And here's a very funny post on IMDb. I was nearly fired from my job because of this movie. I mean, because he was so affected by it, he couldn't sleep and he was late, apparently.
Yeah.
But the thing is, yeah, it's man, check this movie out. Megan is Missing. It was on Netflix, and it is rightfully taken off Netflix.
Yeah,
I can't believe this movie was on Netflix.
Right.
And it's one of the movies where what you don't see is as effective as what you do see in the movie.
But you see,
but you
some
do
very
see quite a bit.
Stuff.
Yes,
like the last 20 minutes of that film, and it comes at you quickly. It's like the next scene you see just is like it just still it gives me chills when I hear it.
Yeah, the guy's talking about the final 22 minutes. There's one scene that's a little before that where they flash the girl's face where she has the thing in her mouth on the screen.
Yeah.
And it literally was like you could torture, you know, the people in Guantanamo Bay with this picture of this girl.
Yeah.
It literally messes you up. Like.
Yeah. I almost tapped out at that point.
Oh, yeah. Brutal.
But yeah, it was, that's what I think of young people. I think that's what they're into. When I think about, like, you know, like people, like, you know, stalking each other on, you know, chat rooms. And
true.
Taking selfies and,
bullying people to death.
Yeah,
bullying people to death. Yes.
You know, and then it's not too far removed from reality too. I mean, there was that thing out in Ohio where those kids like raped some girl and like, you know, tweeted about it, and it's brutal. It's brutal stuff. But that's the American Graffiti of of the 21st
century.
Feel
good hot teen movie. Is that what you're saying?
No. Yeah.
But I mean, wow. See, it's funny. We get all this out of talking about Stephen King. That's how great Stephen King is, you know? But, yeah, Misery, watch it again while the winter is still kicking in. It's a great movie. It's the isolation there, great mood, you know, great performances. Very cool movie, obviously.
So my number three is the amazing Let the Right One In.
Which is my number two.
That's the, of course, the Swedish version.
The original, yes.
The original version. 2008, Tomas Alfredson screenplay mm-hmm. by based on the novel by John Ajvid. And he also had a hand in writing the screenplay as well. So I read the book too. The book
I didn't like read the book. I always wanted to read it. Yeah,
and it's just the book and the movie are great, just as two separate works. I think they're awesome. But once again, it's basically a vampire movie. You know, it tells a story of two kids. You know, Oscar, this sort of outsider, outcast, you know, young, picked on, bullied sort of kid, who becomes friends with Ely, who we think initially is a girl.
Yes, all intents and purposes, looks like a girl, appears to be a girl.
And, you know, her quote-unquote, you know, guardian, this sketchy dude, Hacken.
Yes, who's a pedophile himself.
Yeah.
And is basically, throughout the vampire movie lore, there's always a helper. There's always somebody who's
a familiar.
Kind of a familiar, exactly. Yeah,
it's like Renfield or
and
something.
And this is, yes, this is the familiar of the yeah. movie, correct.
Yeah, so basically he goes out and does all the dirty work in this film. He goes out, finds these people, kills them, bleeds them out, and, you know, and that's how this whole thing goes down. And, yeah, it's, but Ely, you know, she's like, it's actually played by a young girl, Kare Hedebrandt.
Mm, amazing job.
I'm sorry, that's Oscar.
Oh,
these Swedish names, man. So Ely's played
Lena
by
Leanderson.
Yeah, Lena Leanderson.
Yep.
And so yeah, Lena Leanderson plays Ely, and you know she becomes really good friends with Oscar, and you know him being a sort of outcast, and her as well being an outcast because she's a vampire. You know, they become fast friends, and this sort of young, innocent love affair develops, except that we learn that Ely is actually probably hundreds of years old.
Yes.
And was turned into a vampire when she was a young child.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, originally, well, is actually a boy.
Yeah.
And do they really get into that? In the book, they spend a lot of time on
it. I understand
that.
There is a bigger backstory, but isn't it because of the fact something with her age and when she was turned, she's kind of sexless in a way. Like, but
definitely,
although
yeah.
born a boy,
yeah.
Was turned at such a young age that it kind of rendered, you know, him to, you know what I'm saying, to be kind of like not even have like a sexuality or sex.
Well, in the book, you know, he was castrated and brutalized and, you know, it was pretty graphic mm-hmm. about like what happened to Ely.
But the other cool thing about both, you know, the book and this movie and its remake, they take place in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And as a child, like in the early 80s, which I was, I felt that they nailed it. Both movies, I thought, actually nailed it. There's just something about it, something about the looks and the clothing and just the hairstyles. And just I thought they did a very good job of emulating the early 80s.
And it just, the way the movie looks great too. It's shot really well. It's like very dark. Mm. And it feels like the dead of winter.
Yeah.
Everything feels still and cold and quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes place in Sweden, you know, the true north.
Yeah.
And, you know, having been in Sweden in wintertime, it felt pretty accurate to what Sweden's like in the middle of the winter.
Awesome. I love this movie. Again, some people weren't too big on the remake. I enjoyed the remake as well, but this is the superior film. And the director of this, Thomas Alfredson, went on to do a movie which I never got to see, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which got
That's
some nominations in 2011. Yeah. I feel like this is one of the, will go down as one of the greats of the 2000s, definitely.
Yeah.
You know,
really, yeah.
It's already looked upon with as this classic movie.
I don't really feel like it should have been remade, and we can. There's some stuff we're going to talk about later in the show
about
remakes, but the remake came out like on the heels of the release of the European version of it,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I just think that like it's sort of, I think people should expect more out of the fans. You know,
yeah.
I mean. You can. Everyone here, I imagine, who listens to this podcast, I imagine, knows how to read. So, do yourself a favor and watch a couple of movies with subtitles.
Sure.
You know, and watch it in the original vibe and, you know, the way it was intended to be made. You know, in the remake, though, wasn't horrible. It still pales in comparison to the original, mm-hmm. you know, realization of the film by Albertson. And I recommend watching the original over the remake.
Cool. Which brings us to the mother of all winter horror movies for me and Mr. Hill, the 1982 John Carpenter directed The Thing. We have talked about The Thing before, but it's always cool to talk about it again.
Yeah.
A lot of people forget that it was a remake of the 1951 yep. film, The Thing. It had its own prequel in 2011 with the same title yet again,
yep.
a film which I enjoyed, actually. And it's a weird history about the 1982 thing. It came out in June of 1982, which in of itself was something that John Carpenter wasn't really too happy about, apparently, back in the day. And it came out the same day as Blade Runner in 1982.
Wow. Okay.
It debuted at number 8 on the same weekend in 82, and Blade Runner came in at number 2. It was kind of like doomed to begin with. They didn't know what to do with this movie, actually. It got some really weird reviews, too.
Yeah.
I figure we'll take a little bit of a different angle talking about it since sure. we have talked about it before. Here's what Roger Ebert said about this movie in 1982. Disappointing, he said. He called it a great barf bag movie. Wow, sometimes Roger Ebert said some dumb crap, didn't he?
Could that be because of the sort of special effects, maybe?
Ahead of its time, special effects. And he said there was poor characterizations, illogical plot elements, and gave it a 2.5 stars out of 4. Vincent Canby, New York Times, another crap review. Foolish, depressing, overproduced movie that mixes horror with science fiction to make something that is fun as neither one or the other. Wow. And Time magazine gave Rob Bowden some props. His work is novel and unforgettable, but since it exists in a near vacuum emotionally, it becomes too domineering dramatically and an exercise in abstract art. Wow, this movie was like not fondly like accepted at all.
The only thing I could say is that maybe in 1982 when it came out, people didn't have the context for a movie like that.
No, you know what I mean? I think it's the same year, American Werewolf in London, which the transformation scene is up there, but the gore is not as there as the gore and the over the topness of the special effects isn't really there. I mean, they're kind of cousins in a weird way, those two movies, but you're probably right about that.
Because there was like, I mean, you know, people know werewolves, you know, they know what to expect from the werewolf lore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after the 70s, people are used to bloodshed. You know.
Right. They know what a horror movie is.
Right.
They know what the monsters are. But The Thing.
Yeah, The Thing was like some nightmare world.
What is it? What the hell is it?
Yeah.
What is this? It's a monster. It's not a monster I can relate to. I've never seen this monster before.
Yeah.
What is going on? Yeah.
And there's a lot of just scenes, like when they're giving CPR to that guy and his chest opens up and bites the guy's arms off.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
no one's seen that in movies.
No,
before.
No.
Yeah. That's the only thing I can say is that at the time it was such an unusual film that people didn't know how to classify it.
Here's another cool little thing. J. Scott of the Globe and Mail, again, 1982, called the film an absolute hell of an antidote to E.T., which
sure.
came out the same
that's a good,
year.
That's a good...
yes, absolutely. Washington Post, Gary Arnold, a wretched excess. Wow. And Newsweek... There's a big difference between shock effects and suspense, and in sacrificing everything at the altar of gore, Carpenter sabotages the drama. The Thing is so single-mindedly determined to keep you awake that it almost puts you to sleep. Wow. Crazy.
I didn't feel that.
No, I don't either. You know what, though? Carpenter's laughing last, as they say. He is highly celebrated. This movie is highly celebrated. It's been honored multiple times. It was just honored again at BAM here in Brooklyn not too long ago. So I feel like sometimes time does catch up to great art, and obviously it's the case with this movie.
No, definitely.
Because this movie is a lot of people's favorite Carpenter movie.
It's definitely my favorite Carpenter movie.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Hands down.
It's my number two next to Halloween. I have Halloween and this.
I like it more than Halloween.
Interesting.
I mean, I love Halloween, but this one's my top John Carpenter film.
But I feel like this is the mother of winter horrors. It takes place in the winter. I mean, there are no women in this movie. There's an all-male cast. Definitely get the sense of isolation. You get the sense of dread. You have no idea kind of what's coming next. And I bet as the viewer in, like, say, 82, Mike, going to the theater, seeing this movie, it must have been kind of cool to have, or maybe not cool to some people, to have literally nothing to base this on. Like, no basis. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
This is new. This is new horror, you know? Kind of like Videodrome. You see Videodrome in the early 80s back. Like, what the hell did I just watch?
Actually, that's a good point that you bring up, because I feel like Videodrome and The Thing are connected in that conceptual way of, like, because The Thing kind of is a body horror movie.
Body horror, exactly, you know? Yes.
And I saw it on VHS, you know, when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Because, you know, in 1982, I was a little young to go to a horror movie.
Yep.
But, you know, but for me, I loved it immediately, because, like, you know, I mean, probably me and you, we grew up.
Yeah.
In our childhood, reading like Conan the Barbarian and H.P. Lovecraft books.
It was just so crazy. I mean, I didn't really maybe know what the hell I was watching by the time I was watching The Thing, and until later on, obviously, and kind of getting into the story and everything and appreciating the magic of Kurt Russell, which is its own podcast in itself.
The Kurt Russell podcast.
Yes.
Oh,
my goodness. Yes. But to me, it was just a crazy ass movie as a little kid, and I enjoyed watching the insanity to it. You know what I'm saying? But if you're one of the five people who've never seen this movie, you really need to see this movie. And watching it in winter is probably the best time to watch it. Although any time to watch it is good, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I regularly watch it.
Yeah. Oh, and as musicians, this one was not scored by Carpenter. It was scored by Morricone.
Yep.
Ennio Morricone, yeah. He always loved his music, John Carpenter, and he was finally able to get him for this movie. But I've learned over the years that some people are iffy for some reason on some of this soundtrack, or would have preferred that Carpenter did it himself. I don't know. People are weird, but I think it's awesome that this is the one Morricone Carpenter connection. This movie, I think it's great.
I love Ennio Morricone and John Carpenter.
Yeah, totally.
Their scores are both brilliant.
And we have to give a plug to the new John Carpenter album that came out in January.
Oh, yeah. I just picked that one up, too.
It's literally his first standalone album. It's the first album he's ever made. None of these songs are connected to any movies. It's all original music with him and his son. And it's very cool.
Lost Themes.
Yes, it's called Lost Themes. It's on vinyl and CD. The vinyl's beautiful. Gatefold comes with a digital download. I got it, of course. Very cool stuff.
So we're up to number two now?
Well, no, that was we had the same number two and the same number one.
Oh, yeah.
Let the right one in at two and Thing at one.
I have The Shining.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Totally
sorry, yes.
Yeah. So The Shining, once again, how much more can be said about The Shining? 1980, Stanley Kubrick. Stars Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance, Shelley Duvall as Wendy Torrance, Scatman Crothers as Dick Halloran.
Awesome,
and,
in that movie.
And some little kid as Danny Torrance.
Yes.
So the thing is, once again, another Stephen King adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my
one
number
of the
one.
Best.
This
oh,
is
yeah.
my favorite. I know that Stephen King hates this, but
yes, he does. Yes.
For me, definitely... The Shining is my favorite Stephen King adaptation movie. And also a great soundtrack, too.
Oh, very cool soundtrack by Wendy Carlos, formerly Walter Carlos. Yes, he went through a bit of a change. It's a true story. Yeah, I have a bootleg of the soundtrack CD that I got at Chiller, and it's the best $10 I spent. Very cool.
Now, wasn't there... didn't Stephen King write a... sort of a sequel to this about Danny Torrance when he grew up?
I read it last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Dr. Sleep. It is a sequel. Very cool book. I recommend it to you, Mike. It is about Danny Torrance in his late 30s, early 40s, and what's going on in his life. He's had The Shining with him all this time. He had become an alcoholic like his father. He'd gone through a lot of ups and downs. His mom died. He's drifted through jobs and life. And he connects with a very... young girl with a similar power, and who has this group of people called the True Knot that are going after her, and they kind of collect and kill these people with shining like powers all over the country. It's cool book. It's called Dr. Sleep.
Yeah, I want to definitely read that one.
I have it on my iPad, actually. I read it. It's pretty cool. Yeah, check it out. I recommend it to anybody who was a Shining fan. You get to catch up with Danny Lloyd in the present day. It's very cool.
One of the things that about that movie in particular is, like, when I saw it when I was very young, and as I got older, I picked up more on the subtle hints of Jack Nicholson's character being an alcoholic, number one, and also being kind of a piece of shit to his family.
Yes, yes. That's one of the things that Stephen King, one of the many things that he didn't like. He felt that right off the bat, you thought Jack Nicholson was insane. Whereas in the book, Jack Torrance starts out as a very normal guy, actually. And he's a teacher. And he's, you know, he happens to be an alcoholic. But he's not psychotic. Stephen King didn't like that. I don't know. He thought that was like, there was nothing leading up to, like, you already sense there's something wrong with this guy right away. But yeah, there are some subtle nuances. I mean, the way he treats his wife and the way he talks to his wife and the backstory that is touched upon, how he hurt Danny's shoulder or arm, which is in way more detail in the book and stuff like that. The cool thing about the movie is the what we don't know and what we're never told and what we're left to make up throughout our lives of this movie. Whereas, was he seeing all this?
Yeah.
Was it all in his head? What happened? What didn't happen? That's the, to me, that makes for, you know, the coolness of the movie, you know?
Yeah, that's just like good filmmaking, you know what I'm saying? Like the way that subtle sort of vibe gets put out there. And I think it's way more interesting that Jack is like a flawed character. Like he's a guy of sort of like a low vibration, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But that makes him receptive. His sort of low vibration and like poor character makes him like open to being, you know, potentially possessed by some other, you know, entity or whatever the hell. Like, once again, we don't even really know what happened to him. Like, he just went crazy, he saw everything, or was he actually being guided down this path, you know? So, I just think that's interesting. I think the subtlety of that I thought was cool.
Oh, totally, yeah.
You know?
But, I mean, basically, you can't really go wrong with any of these movies, in my opinion, for winter horror films. You know, The Thing, Shining, Misery, Let the Right One In, Ravenous, Frozen, 30 Days of Night, and I believe I just mentioned all of them.
Yeah?
Yes.
We had a couple runners-up, too, I think.
Yeah.
For me, it was Dead Snow 2.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much Dead Snow 1. I saw both of them, obviously, but the first one didn't grab me. The second one I thought was a lot more fun. It was like a lot more engaging. And
yes.
It wasn't, it was cool.
A lot of people have been talking about Dead Snow in the past few months and the sequel on Facebook and whatnot, and a lot of people really loved it. I wasn't as floored by the first one. I just thought it was a little silly. And I don't know. Norwegian horror, apparently. It might not be a big forte, but... but I did feel like the second one had more to it and more to enjoy, and I enjoyed the Nazis versus Germans, and I also enjoyed the even more over-the-top special effects and craziness that went into part two that might not have been in part one. These movies, they're more fun. There's nothing scary whatsoever about Dead Snow 1 and 2. Excuse me. Sorry about that. They are horror movies. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But... You're not scared in any instance, I felt like, in these movies. I mean, I wasn't. But it is an enjoyable horror.
The only thing, and it's going to be a spoiler, so if you haven't seen Dead Snow 2, close your ears or do something else right now. But at the end of Dead Snow 2, when he resurrects his girlfriend, okay, there's a scene where they're either A, having sex in the back of the car.
That's what I got out of it.
Or B, she's eating him.
Ah, okay, you're not sure. Okay, that's cool.
Like, at first I'm like, oh, it must be, he's having sex with her. But then I'm like, hold on a second. When the credits started rolling, I was like, or did she attack him and kill him?
I immediately just went to sex, probably. But now that you think about it, we don't know. And the movie ends, and that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe we're not supposed to know.
Yeah. Or maybe I was just completely off base with it, you know? But that's if that was the intent of the movie, I thought was cool.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love Rue Morgue magazine, and me and Mike both love it. We've been reading it forever, well over 10 years, 15 years. Yeah. And this next movie we're going to talk about came to my attention from Rue Morgue. It's called Housebound, and it is a New Zealand horror film that is, again, it's getting really a lot of press lately. I've been seeing a lot of people on, like, the Facebook horror groups talk about it, and, you know, horror message boards and the like. And I think it's for good reason. Some people I've learned are not as floored by this movie as others. Some people found it a little boring. But I thought this was a really cool movie. It's a horror comedy. I normally don't really like horror comedy, to be completely honest. To me, I like Return of the Living Dead. And for some reason, people call American Werewolf in London a horror comedy. I don't even really get that much myself. But maybe that's another one I like, and maybe the original Fright Night, which I could see as a horror comedy. I do like that movie a lot. Other than that, I really have no use for horror comedies. But we touched a little bit, I'm just going to divulge this a little, about remakes.
Yeah.
This movie just came out in January in America. It came out in New Zealand in March, and it screened at South by Southwest early this year before it got the U.S. distribution and U.S. release. And it is already, apparently, going to be remade by New Line Cinema, a movie that has come out 60-something days ago in America. Again, this movie is in New Zealand. They speak English in New Zealand. There are no subtitles. Yep. This movie is in English, with actors speaking in the English language. And I feel like, let a movie breathe a little before you're going to remake a movie. No, I mean, let it reach its who it needs to reach, and let it have its life before your crappy American version comes along and steals its thunder. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I have a big issue with these remakes. I mean, another one of my favorite movies, Martyrs, is being remade. Or it's done already, you're saying.
It's very fastly done, apparently. Yeah. And if you've listened to the podcast and you've seen the movie, it's not a remake movie.
No.
You're not supposed to remake that movie.
No.
I'm sorry. It is a very bleak, dark, fairly disgusting horror movie.
Yeah.
French film that I see no reason to touch that movie whatsoever. I see very little marketable qualities of that film in America whatsoever. I see a hell of a lot more marketable qualities in Housebound, let's be honest.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a lighthearted sort of thing, you know.
And the story is interesting.
Yeah.
But what makes me feel that way about it is the damn original version. You know what I'm saying? Is the real version. Like, why not just everybody enjoy this great movie from another country? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think probably a better way of handling it is what they did with Shaun of the Dead. You know, how Shaun of the Dead was a British film, but then it got, instead of remaking Shaun of the Dead, which is probably what they would have done if that movie came out later, they just...
They gave it a proper
release in the U.S., and it got a lot of, you know, press behind it, and it got a good push, and... And it's Shaun of the Dead is, like, you know, sort of an iconic movie at this point.
Absolutely. This didn't really get much of a U.S. release. It got U.S. DVD Blu-ray, came out in the beginning of January. And, it is on Netflix now. Initially, it was only on iTunes and Amazon. That's where I watched it on Amazon. I watched it in January. And it's just amazing how sometimes word of mouth moves with horror, really. And honestly, I'm going to put it on... being on the covers of magazines like Rue Morgue.
Oh, yeah.
That dictates a lot. If you're on the cover of that magazine, and you're not an American movie, you're going to get a lot of attention up the ass by Americans.
Well, that's exactly how, a few years ago, there was that explosion of French films.
Mm-hmm.
Martyrs, Inside.
They all were on the covers of Rue Morgue. Exactly, yes.
All that stuff. And, you know, the Belgian film, Calvert.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I definitely heard about that
from Rue Morgue. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this may have definitely had a play as well with this movie. It's funny because Rue Morgue doesn't do anything in February. They do a January-February issue. And... you know, it's at every Barnes & Noble I go to. I mean, it's very easy to come by.
Yeah.
But it's also becoming one of the only horror magazines out there. Fangoria is out there, but I feel like I see Rue Morgue in more places than I see Fangoria, which is kind of interesting because it is a Canadian magazine. But it is a lot better of a magazine than Fangoria is, in my opinion. But I just feel like it's cool that a movie is getting some great press and some great word of mouth and getting legs. But like I said, along comes the U.S. movie machine to shove their hand in and pull a movie out. I mean, who knows? Maybe it'll be a great movie. But you know what? Like I said, I just feel like let a movie breathe and have a life.
It just seems like a waste of resources to retell something that's almost, you know, is virtually a brand new film.
Yeah, that's the thing. The cool thing about this movie, it mixes like a ghost story, a murder mystery, a comedy, and even a little bit of a family drama to it, in a way, because of the dynamic of the daughter and the mother and, like, the stepfather, you know? And someone even likened it to almost like a... Like, remember People Under the Stairs?
Oh, yeah, great. That
definitely
made for
a little
TV,
bit,
right?
No, that was in theaters, like 90, 91. Wasn't a big hit. But it was kind of similar story, a little bit, to this movie. But it has won all sorts of awards in its native homeland. It did very well at South by Southwest. Fangoria gave it 3 out of 4 skulls. Carries some universal ideas about throwaway childish indignation and rebellion and getting to know your parents as people with pasts and personal lives and not just nagging overseers. To me, I thought the ghost story aspect of it was cool.
Yeah.
But in reality... I don't want to say too much, but things are not what they seem as far as the quote-unquote ghost is concerned.
Yeah, it's a perception.
It's a bit of a... right, exactly. It's not all what you think it's going to be with the whole ghost aspect.
And the characters were good, too, you know?
No, absolutely.
Likeable characters.
The star, her name is Morgana O'Reilly. Very, very attractive young woman.
I liked her.
Carries the film. She's kind of a badass. She gets in a lot of trouble. And the name Housebound comes from the fact that she herself... is a housebound via her criminal activities and wearing an ankle bracelet that where she cannot leave the house.
Yeah.
It has, I think, those kind of cool early New Zealand Peter Jackson touches to it.
Oh, you know what? I was thinking the same thing when I was
watching
it. It
really does. And that's another thing that gives it some of its charm.
Yeah.
Especially with some of the character dynamics. And, you know, Peter Jackson's movies definitely have... his more crazy-ass horror ones had some comedy to them, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Although I always feel like that horror comedy tag kind of denotes a movie a little bit. But at the end of the day, Peter Jackson had a great sense of humor with his movies. That's, you know, absolutely.
But I think, like, the horror comedy, though I generally shy away from those types of films, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're bad. Like, I really like Shaun of the Dead quite a bit.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And that Dead Snow 2 I liked a lot.
And another good one, Zombieland. Is it a pretty good movie?
Zombieland works as both as comedy and horror, because there's there are some moments in that film where it's like they're horrific moments. You know, and there's like tension and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Same thing with Shaun of the Dead.
But yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I believe Housebound was being shown for a little bit here in Manhattan, but like I said, the Blu-ray and DVD is out and it is on Netflix. It is definitely worth a watch. Some people found it a little boring. My brother John thought it was just okay. He thought it was a little overhyped. Didn't see what all the hype was. I'm like, okay, you know. But again, you know, people kind of pissed off a little bit about the remake, and obviously you and I have our opinions about the remake.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be remade, man. I mean, it's like let it sort of naturally find its audience, and because it will. I mean, that's the thing I love about horror movies. Even if they're not huge successes right off the bat, they sort of leech their way into, like, the fans.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And things they don't have to have, like, a huge opening day or whatever, opening week. It's, like, it's more about, like, you know, especially the films that you and I like, you know, a lot of the times they don't even get legit releases. They just sort of appear for a week and they disappear. Then you find out about it and you download it or you watch it on iTunes or... you know, buy the Blu-ray or whatever, you know, and that's really what the sort of the way that you consume all this stuff is through those means. So I mean, yeah, it's like, it's almost like it's taken that away from this film.
Yeah.
By remaking it so quickly and putting it out probably in, it's going to probably be in like all theaters. You know?
It'll be a major movie, I bet. I would imagine. Or like I had said before the show started, sometimes some of these remakes get just shoved out. Like they don't get any kind of treatment. They get just pushed out on DVD and it's like, oh, look, here it is. And you find it, however, and you know, but this one, I think more likely to be probably something with a big push.
One of the most insulting remakes, though, is a Quarantine remake of Rec, the Spanish film.
Yes, yes.
I'm not mad at the remake of Quarantine. I think it's okay. But, you know, in watching the extras on the DVD and everything, the guy doesn't even talk about the original film.
About Rec? Mm.
And I'm like, you made a scene for scene cover of a song. It's like covering like a Misfits song and being like, oh, I wrote, you know, not mentioning that
Glenn
Danzig
wrote. This is this great song
it.
I wrote. Right, yeah. Exactly.
Well, check this out. Check out this recording of a song that's me singing.
Oh, my God.
And it's
God.
Like, you know, but you fail to mention that Glenn Danzig wrote the lyrics and, you know, and the music. And so that's how I feel about the Quarantine.
That's what some people said about Ty West, The Sacrament, that he was passing this off as this original idea, when in reality, it has really been done about 2-3 times already.
Yeah, and especially in the, you know, Ty West is a horror filmmaker, mm-hmm. and that concept is nothing new, and, you know, fans of the genre have seen those films.
Yeah.
And you need to, like, come correct with that, you know,
totally.
And just give credit where it's due, you know. Seen anything you like lately?
Yes. A friend of mine, Vic, from New Jersey, he's the guy I go to chiller with for past, you know, I don't know, 8 years. We always go together, good friend of mine. He just sends me a text out of nowhere. You got to see this movie on Netflix, on Showtime on demand, called Cold in July. It's got really cool music. That's all he says. Cool score. Like, you know, kind of John Carpenter. Says really nothing about the movie at all, other than that.
Huh.
So I'm like, okay, I'll check it out. So I look it up, and I see that one of my favorite actors is in it, Don Johnson, who I actually really do love.
Yeah.
I'm a big Miami Vice fan. And it's got Michael C. Hall from Dexter as one of the stars, and Sam Shepard as another star. And then I do a little more digging, and it's directed by Jim Mickle, who directed We Are What We Are, one of the best horror movies I thought of last year. And it's based on a Joe R. Lansdale novel, who is a writer I've always known, I've always heard his name, never read any of his books, and now I kind of want to read this book. This movie, it didn't go to theaters, even though it has, you know, fairly known people in it. It went kind of right to, you know, DVD, on demand, whatever. It's a kind of a southern noir revenge movie set in like 1989.
Oh, cool. I love stuff in the 80s.
Yes. And it came out, actually came out in January of last year. It was at Sundance. And like I said, I'm very surprised it didn't get any kind of like theatrical release or anything. It doesn't look like a ton was spent on it, but I mean, it is a cool movie nonetheless. Very small budget, estimated, you know, just $2-3 million movie or whatever. It came out on home video in September of 2014. Michael C. Hall is a, you know, young guy with his wife who kind of gets caught up by this, like, local kind of town psychotic. And basically, one night someone has broken into his house, and he wakes up, and it's like an intruder with, you know, his face covered, whatever, and he kills the man in his house, right? And he doesn't get any kind of legal trouble because the man was in his house, and, you know, it's in the South, and, you know, they have their intruder, you know, you can shoot whoever comes in your house kind of laws kind of thing going on. You know what I'm saying? You know, protect yourself kind of thing. But what happens is the relative, well, the father of the man he kills, is kind of coming looking for revenge. You know, it's got a little bit of that movie. What's that movie with De Niro, which was the remake from the early 90s?
Oh, Cape Fear.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely starts out with a little bit of that vibe going
nice.
On to it.
Okay. Okay.
As the movie progresses, you learn that the man that Michael C. Hall killed at his house is not the guy's son. It's got a little bit of a twist to it.
Yeah.
This is where Don Johnson enters the picture. Don Johnson is like a private investigator, and it deals with like a lot of kind of, you know, southern town corruption and things not really being what they seem. But throughout the movie, there is a very cool kind of John Carpenter-y synth score to it, which and some people thought it was kind of almost out of place. I actually thought it was kind of lended to making the movie a little cooler, you know? It's supposed to be 1989. There's definitely some mullets in it and some 1989 clothes. One of the other cool things about it is the usage of a White Lion song, which was big in the summer of 89, called Wait.
Oh, yeah.
I actually liked White Lion you know, one of my hair metal bands, you know, that I actually thought was pretty cool. So it was kind of weird to see one of their songs in a movie. It's used twice in the movie. At the end, and then at a very kind of sketchy scene in the middle. But I don't want to say too much about it because it has a few twists and turns to it. And it's worth seeing on your own. But it kind of mixes genres, and that's where it kind of like lost some people, you know? like, I'll read some of the reviews. It was like pulpy neo-noir that goes gleefully haywire. Then the Los Angeles Times wrote that, you know, it grabs you from the first moments and rarely loses hold to the last drop. Slant Magazine, very, you know, compulsively watchable. But AV Club gave it a B-, that it thrillingly shuffles genres before settling on a dumb one.
Yeah.
You know. That's the thing. I feel like maybe the book is kind of a mix of styles and stories, and that kind of bleeds through into this movie because it goes from noir to like drama to mystery to revenge. Like, you know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
To me, if you like all that crap already, that may not be such a bad thing.
I like,
you know,
all that stuff.
Right, exactly. Don Johnson has a really cool role in this movie and does a great job. Probably one of the most underused and underrated actors ever, in my opinion. But the thing is, there's a really kind of dark, shady, like True Detective-y element to it, actually, that I think is very cool, that deals with, like, you know, human trafficking of, like, underage immigrant girls. Like, there's some shady, like, found footage stuff in there, and there's some shady, like, you know, like, you find out what some of these guys have really done that are in law enforcement, and, you know what I'm saying? It's just some dark shit in it, too, that makes it even cooler. But it's called Cold in July. It's on Showtime on demand. Yeah, I just thought it was a cool movie. You know, it's not a horror movie, but it's definitely a, you know, revenge dark movie that I think is up the alley of people that might, you know, be listening.
Now, do you recommend that, like, you know, as a purchase or?
You know what? The thing is, if you have Showtime, you can watch for free. It's not on Netflix right now. If you can get the disc for a decent price, I would say yes. It is worth a purchase, in my opinion, if you can get it at a decent price. If you can get it on Amazon or iTunes for rental, absolutely go for it, you know.
Because I don't have Showtime.
Oh, okay, exactly.
Yesterday, Mike, I just now got cable.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know what I mean? And it's like the first time in my adult life that I've, and I've been an adult for a long time.
Yes.
I've actually had cable TV in my apartment here.
Well, there's a cool channel called MeTV, and the other night they were showing Hammer films. They showed Brides of Dracula the other night. So you can see cool crap like that now on television.
That's on cable?
Yeah, MeTV. They show old Batman reruns.
What Wonder Woman reruns. I have Time Warner.
It's on Time Warner. I'm just not sure of the channel, but it's called MeTV. It's got a lot of, like, Hogan's Heroes and, like, a lot of 60s and 70s stuff. You get to see how devastatingly hot Linda Carter was every day. Like, Wonder Woman's on, like, every day. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, she's
pretty amazing. Something else, man. Oh, yeah. Ridiculous.
Yeah, I got a package with HBO.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, I got a phone. I got a landline now.
Oh, very cool.
DVR.
No, I mean, there's great stuff on HBO. There's great stuff on cable. So congratulations.
What about Epics?
Epics? I think my brother has Epics. I don't have Epics. I just have Showtime and HBO proper. I don't have Cinemax. I do not have Epics. Epics has all the Marvel movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Showtime and HBO have none of those movies.
So they threw that in. As like you get that with everything. So I got this cool package. You know, it wasn't without some drama though that you have to deal with these cable companies sometimes.
But you know what, man? We're in a golden age of television, and I think we have been for the last 5-7 years at least. So there's great stuff on TV.
Speaking of the golden age of TV, have you been up on Walking Dead?
Yes, but not Sundays. Okay. I might try to watch Sundays tonight.
Yeah.
But this second half season, all the episodes have been good.
Mm-hmm.
No episodes of The Boring Dead have been on.
Yeah.
It has been very good Walking Dead.
No, I'm into it. There was a lull, you know, and now it's back full force.
No, I am digging the season. I just have not watched the new episode, which I heard is another banger. So,
a movie that I saw recently was Nightcrawler.
I got to see this movie.
Yeah. It's got Jake Gyllenhaal in it. You know, and It's not definitely not a horror film,
right.
But it's just like a movie about a creep, basically, who he's kind of a loser, shady guy. In the beginning of the film, we see him stealing chain link fences and selling it to a construction company.
Oh, God.
And the guy's like, you know, thinks he's a piece of shit, rightfully so. And then the epiphany of his life is when he sees an automobile accident and how there's these camera crews that show up to film it and then sell the footage to the news.
Oh, God. Wow.
So that gives him an idea to start filming, you know, to get a police scanner and sort of chase down these crimes.
Wow.
Or not crimes, but accidents. And it turns into, like, a couple of crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a super dark movie.
Wasn't there rumblings of an award for him for this? But he didn't get it. He didn't get the nomination or anything.
In my world, in the universe that I would like to live in, he would have gotten an award for this film.
Okay. See, I heard it's pretty damn crazy.
Great job in it. And, you know, it's a very unique film. Like, you don't see this angle. I got to tell you, though, it does remind me, if you're familiar with the writer James Ellroy, who wrote, you know, The Black Dahlia,
LA
Confidential, and,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Other books. What reminds me of it, it's not so much that this is like a James Ellroy style crime movie, but Ellroy, and I read his biography a number of years ago called My Dark Places, and he talks about, you know, when he was writing in the early part of his life, he would chase police cars to the scene of a crime.
I see,
and
like, yeah.
And it has that vibe to it. That's of like cool. This sort of very driven person, very motivated, but clearly, you know, there's some sociopathic tendencies that this guy has. Similar to James Ellroy. I think James Ellroy is a brilliant writer, he's successful, but I think that deep down there's like a sociopathic side to that guy. And that's why, you know, that's why I love him. I love his writing.
Cool.
Know? But yeah, that's another film that I just watched that just a few days ago. It was great.
Yeah, I want to see that movie. I mean, so he's the Nightcrawler, right? Like he's like that's the who they're referring to.
Yes.
It's like this creature who not creature, but like creature, you know, not literally, but like he's kind of prowling the streets for like, you know, the footage and whatnot and, you know, gotcha, like a shady guy.
Yeah, and Bill Paxton has a small part in it. And, you know, I always love Bill Paxton. So you mentioned that you recently saw Tusk.
Yes, I finally saw Tusk about 3 weeks ago, and I'm still not over it. This movie fucked me up, man, I have to say. Like, I was not prepared for this movie. I did very little, you know, pre-research. I knew it was horror-esque. I knew it was a crazy movie. I knew there was something crazy in the movie. And I knew it had to do with a walrus to an extent, but I didn't know what exactly was going to happen in the movie, which was great to watch this movie and not know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I was shocked. I've never seen Red State, so I have never known this newer Kevin Smith with his darker side. So to see this movie and not even having seen Red State made this movie even more kind of like a crazy for me, you know, like, I just couldn't believe that this came from the mind of Kevin Smith. I couldn't believe it. Like, wow. Like, I would never have guessed in a million years if someone gave me a piece of paper, his five directors, who directed this movie. And Kevin Smith is one of them. He would not have been within the first three choices of people who directed the movie. But now, in hindsight, I see his touches a little bit here dialogue. And there. I do. In the dialogue is where I really kind of see it. But, man, this was such a un-Kevin Smith film, I feel like. But I think that's what he wanted to do. And that's – the mission is accomplished. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I can basically now see him tackling another horror movie if he liked, another bizarre kind of movie if he liked. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
And that, to me, is a sign of a good director. I mean – If all you're known for is, like, you know, these kind of goofy comedies or, like, these, you know, culty 90s movies, whatever, you know, people would lump him in with, he probably wanted to stretch his wings, and he definitely stretched his wings, and I think he did a great job.
Yeah, I you know, I'm a fan of his podcast. I listen to it pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. And so I was in on the whole development of the movie.
Wow.
You know, like, I knew about, you know, it's not based on a true story, but right. the story started as something that came to his attention with a gag that this British guy put out there. And so, yeah, it was sort of developed from this thing that actually happened in real life. It was a joke, but, you know, sort of put out there. And then he just kind of took that kernel of an idea and, like, ran with it.
One thing I've read and found is that suppose some people feel like because he's become a way bigger pothead in the last couple of years.
Well, he didn't smoke weed for most of his life, and that in the last
until his like late 30s apparently. Yeah. That all the weed has made him have these different types of thoughts and different ideas. I mean, who knows if that's true?
I can see that.
It could be, right? I mean, it could be, but you know, that's some people's school of thought. Like he now is open to things that he never probably would have been dreamed of making movies about, you know.
I like Kevin Smith. I think he's a funny guy, but I'm 50-50 with his movies, honestly.
I did not like Zack and Miri Make a Porno. I thought he completely dropped the ball with that one and made a really tame romantic comedy, in essence, with some nudity in it.
Yeah.
I never saw Jersey Girl. I love Clerks. I love Chasing Amy, and I love Mallrats.
Mallrats, my favorite.
I love Dogma. I like Clerks, too. I don't love it. I like it.
I enjoy Clerks, too.
I like it.
I saw it way, way later after the fact.
But I never saw that Bruce Willis movie, which supposedly he hates himself, too. The one where he had very little kind of say in it other than being the director. I can't think of the name of that movie. It's about cops.
Cop Out.
Cop Out. I want to see that. I almost want to see Jersey Girl just out of morbid curiosity. But Red State, you said, is a good movie.
I enjoyed Red State.
Right, right. But so actually, if you on paper, I guess I do like the majority of his movies. You know, technically, yeah. The majority.
I'm like, I can't, like, I didn't like Chasing Amy, you know, and I figured I'd give it another shot, watch it again, and it was like, I barely could make it through
the movie. Interesting.
Yeah. I like Mallrats, Dogma was great, of course Clerks was like, you know, that's put him on the map.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. Know?
And that was like a movie to be, I mean, basically Kevin Smith was at the right time at the right place.
Sure.
And that's his whole, like, career, you know. But, yeah, I like him as a person. I think he's cool. I got the book that he wrote. I thought it was interesting. His podcast is great, you know, and all that sort of stuff. I don't know if I like Tusk or not. It's interesting, the idea, but I don't know if it really worked for me. The ending was a total downer.
Yes. Sad, it's a pretty bleak movie.
Bleak ending.
Yeah.
I think that you're kind of kept off balance because of the humor elements in it, too.
Yeah, there is humor, and it's almost like you don't think you should be laughing at all, but you're laughing, maybe, right?
Exactly.
Or you're kind of like, well, what the fuck is that?
Right. It's like if Mallrats had like a totally downer ending. It's like kind of like how if everyone died in a plane crash at the end of the movie or something like that. You know, it's that sort of thing.
I don't think he wanted people to think Tusk was funny, did he?
No,
want people to think Tusk was funny?
I think that it was his entry into like doing straight up horror, you know, body horror or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And but I think that just the way he expresses himself is with a humorous voice, and that's why the movie has those elements in it.
Right.
You know, and
right.
that's who he is, man. Yeah. You know, he's a funny guy.
He is a funny guy.
But I don't, you know, I actually purchased it on iTunes because I just assumed I'd love it, you know. But I don't know if I'll watch it again.
I'm just deeply disturbed by some of the imagery and like the face, his face. Like I can't. Yeah. You know, it's creepy.
I recommend it. I mean, if it shows up on Netflix or something like that, check it out. If you have Netflix or you know, rental, you know, some streaming system that's out there, if it's available, check it out. But yeah, it's definitely not. It, even if you're a fan of horror, I don't know if you really would like it because of the funny parts. And, you know?
Right.
But you know.
It goes into a few different areas. I mean, for the most part, it's a shocking movie. It's you know, it definitely has some shocking moments in it. You know, and the whole concept is pretty freaky. But yeah, some people thought the execution was a little. What is he doing? Like, what is he saying? Like, what is he trying to say?
Yeah.
You know? But maybe it's not supposed to be analyzed that way. Who the hell knows, you know? But I await Clerks 3, which is happening, and I await whatever else he does. We'll see what else he's doing, you know?
I just picked up a new soundtrack by Simon Boswell.
Mm-hmm.
It's the soundtrack to the movie Hardware.
Oh, very nice. Where'd you get it?
I ordered it.
Vinyl, CD?
Vinyl.
Oh, shit. Yep. I find that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's two LPs. It's
what
like
label?
Some random fucking label.
Okay. Not Death Waltz?
Like, you know, it looks like a Death Waltz release.
But it's
it's not.
Okay. I will.
And they have, you know, you can find it on Amazon. And I've always loved that movie, the Richard Stanley film.
Absolutely.
Richard Stanley's like his admitted ripoff of the Terminator, even though it's not a Terminator rip, I don't see it as that.
10% of Terminator.
Yeah, I mean, there's like, a psychotic robot.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
That's what the movie. It's a robot film. It's got Dylan McDermott in it. It has
great
cameos
movie.
By Iggy Pop's voice is in it, and there's a Lemmy cameo.
Lemmy Motorhead, Carl McCoy from Fields of Metal.
Carl McCoy is in the opening scenes.
Great movie.
And really, really good film. If you're unfamiliar with Richard Stanley, definitely check him out. He doesn't have a lot of films out. You know, Dust Devil.
Kind of I'll call him a Hollywood outsider, let's say, at the very least. Yes.
Yeah. And I think that he originally was slated to direct The Island of Dr. Moreau.
He shot a good chunk of it, yes, and then was replaced. That is correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
But he's, you know, a very interesting guy. I mean, he definitely has a vision, and I feel like he was very young when he made those movies, too.
Yes, he was.
I mean, he's not an old guy. He's not even 50 years old.
No.
And he kind of disappeared. He was a South African filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
He
did documentaries.
Documentaries.
Music videos.
Yeah, Fields of the Nephilim videos. Mm-hmm. I think he did Skinny Puppy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, so you see him around.
Subversive dude.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely check those out. There's legit versions of that movie available now.
But I think the ones you and I have, I believe it is out of print. The Severin Films, I think that deluxe version is out of print.
Yeah.
It's worth the buy. It's a great movie.
But the soundtrack, though, man, it's like definitely if you're a fan of like, you know, that John Carpenter
synthy stuff,
or, you know, it's like that. It's very ambient, very atmospheric. And it's something that, like, you know, if you're like hanging out on a Saturday afternoon, put it on.
Yeah.
It's like one of those long listens.
Most people I know who've seen it have fallen in love with it. I mean, I've never really had anybody say the movie sucked. I mean, it's like a movie you find and it's like, oh shit, I really like this movie, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's got some hot redhead in it.
Yes. I used to watch it on VHS. I remember when it came out in 1990. I remember renting it. I remember loving it. And, you know, it's definitely a movie that has legs and has had legs and has a cult following.
Right on.
Yeah. But this was a great podcast, man. The Dregs of Winter, number 8.
Yeah.
I hope the next time we get together, it is above freezing, and there's at least just maybe a little snow on the ground, some April snow maybe on the ground, for God's sake.
Well, you know, we're in March, and technically this is supposed to be, you know, the weather starts getting nicer, at least up here in the Northeast.
You know? Yeah, sometimes April can really suck, though, in New York, man. That's the thing, but hopefully not this year. Hopefully we get winter out of the way when it's supposed to be out of the way. But that's probably not happening.
All right, guys. So until next time.
Yes, thank
you. This is Mike and Mike at the Necromaniacs Podcast. Have a good night.
Have a great one. Take care.